Welcome back, guys. It's totally unrelated. I'm your host, Adrian Cosby. It's Tuesday morning. Thanks for joining me. I started to record this podcast several times this week and just never felt confident in what I was generating. So here goes this episode. It's with Joe Young. And for those of you that don't know Joe, he's an up-and-coming comedian, just started about a year ago. And he's come a long way in a very short time and still has a long way to go, but certainly is doing things the right way from what I can tell, making his own opportunities and just taking advice in general from his peers. It's a true testament to the fact that, the comedy community wants comedians to succeed. It's not like we're out there giving people bad advice, or your peers are giving bad advice in comedy. And I think it's never been more apparent than with a guy like Joe, because he seems to be taking the advice that he wants to take, and it seems to be working for him. So that's what today's interview is going to be. I just had a weird thing happen. I was setting up for this podcast, and I was going to do it on my PC, and then I thought, no, let me do it on my laptop so I can edit out the sound. And in the indecision, I decided to go back to my PC. And in the moment that I went back to my PC, it is upgrading to Windows 10. And it's 12% done, and it's been working on it for a while now. And I'm kind of annoyed with that. I'm glad it didn't happen to both computers at the same time, because I need to get this up. But I'm faster on the PC with editing than I am on my laptop, and that's just the bare bones truth of it, guys. Had a big week last week. We did Rock on the Range. Was in Toledo for a couple nights, which is always fun. Toledo was the first club weekend I ever had when I first started doing comedy, and so it's always fun to visit those guys. Let me adjust this. This might make some noise. Boom. Edit. Yeah. So I went up to Toledo with my good friend. Jace, my best good friend Jay Snyder, we had a good time up there, and for a couple days, Wednesday and Thursday of last week, saw the open mic, some good comics and some starting out comics, and shout out to my boy Reese Leonard, who had to follow Deadline. Deadline was a first time doing comedy, tore the roof off the place. She brought about half the audience, but. If it's your first time doing comedy and you already have a catchphrase name like Deadline, sky's the limit, guys. You're gonna go far and fast, and you're gonna be diverse. You're gonna have traction in all the markets. So Reese had to follow Deadline, rather unsuccessfully, and in fact, I think Deadline even told him to get off the stage. So that's nice. Your first time doing comedy and you're already heckling other comedians. After his set, all of Deadline's people left, and I was left with about 14 to 18 really attentive white people. And they were very nice. And I did some new jokes, and I was happy with them. And then Thursday night was a little bit, well, much better. It was a regular show, but we had a lot of guest sets. And, did real well, had fun, came home, and that night got a good night's sleep, and then went to Rock on the Range on Friday, which was amazing. I didn't really know what to expect, but if you've never heard of Rock on the Range, it's a 3-day music festival in Columbus, Ohio, at the Columbus Crew Stadium, and it sold out in a couple hours, I think, this year, and it was packed. I mean, it was incomprehensible the amount of people just walking around outside. But then when I was leaving, I got a shot of a band playing on the main stage inside the Crew Stadium, and it was just packed wall to wall, every seat. I don't know who was playing, but I took a video of it, and I think I've since deleted it. But it was just a crowd shot. It's on my Instagram, the crowd shot is. Check it out. The show went really well. The comedy went really well. I had to open up to a completely cold audience. I think some people were just hanging out in the tent because they were trying to get out of the sun or the rain. It was raining. It was sunny when we got there, then it started raining. And by the time the show started, the tent was completely full. At least 500 people sitting, and probably another 200 people just standing in the back. It was electric. Probably the best opening set I've ever had, where you just walk out on stage and start doing comedy without any kind of like, ladies and gentlemen, are you ready? And yeah, it's a good time. Everybody did really well. And I got to meet Jay Mohr, who was the headliner. Not really meet, you know, I got to be around. I got to stand near Jay Mohr. And he kind of gave me the look like, I know you're a comic. Calm down. I didn't say anything. I didn't have that overeager look like, like I was gonna, like I couldn't wait to say something. I was really just quiet the whole time. I had a pretty good headache working most of the day. And he didn't come until right before his set, so I didn't want to disturb him. And then after his set, he came off stage and was kind of just shooting the shit. And no brag, but you know, I don't know where that yawn came from. No brag, but you know, I made him laugh, made him do a spit take. Just shooting the shit about his joke that he did about being in a tent, and I astutely observed that it was the best tent joke I'd ever heard while actually in a tent. There was more words and setup and pause and timing. It's very difficult to explain comedy to the lay person, but let's just say he bent over and spit a little bit of his drink out. And then later that night, he retired to the headliner's trailer. I was not invited. Much like the assistant on a farm several hundred years ago would not be invited in to dinner after the work was done. But they didn't have power into their trailer, but they had a giant oversized generator, like the kind of generator that you could use to operate a grow room. They had for this little tiny trailer, and they couldn't figure out how to get the power on. And some of you may know that I used to have a former life as a construction worker, so I stepped my ass over to that generator and I looked at it for about 3 minutes before I started switching switches, and got it started, and power turned on to the trailer. So I'm not gonna say I was the hero of the Friday night portion of the comedy festival, but whatever is like just below hero, like a saint, I don't know. I don't want to put too fine of a point on it. Let's just say I was incredibly important, and Jay Mohr will always remember me as the person who turned the power on at Rock on the Range, even though he didn't actually see that it was me that did it. Okay? Let's keep it going. This week I'll be in Hartford, Connecticut. I leave tomorrow. Tomorrow night, which is Wednesday, the 25th, they're doing a Clash of the Comics. So I'll be there hanging out, hopefully judging that. Maybe I'll do a podcast with whoever's there. And then Thursday through Sunday performing. And then Monday is a holiday, and I fly back like late in the afternoon. So it's going to be a rough day next Monday. I'm going to be like hanging out in the airport for hours and hours and hours before I have to leave, which is the worst. I'm not going to lie. It's always the worst. But I'll get some work done. I'll probably record a podcast in the airport. I don't know how you guys liked that last time. Judging by statistics, not very well, even though it was a great episode. Let's keep it moving. I gotta keep it moving. I want to keep it moving. I don't know if you guys are into Drake or if you've heard Drake's new album, but I am currently in love with it. Okay? It's like more than 12 songs, and pretty much all of them are good. If you like that kind of music. If you don't like that kind of music, you'll be like, these are all terrible. I think that's it. Let's go right into the podcast. And if you're a comic out there, I want to say this. This isn't directed at anyone in particular, but I want to say the guest set is getting a little bit tiresome. It's not anything that I've ever done unprompted. I think maybe once I asked for a guest set and got it. I may have asked for three in my life, but I think a guest set, I think in some people's minds, a guest set, which is like where you're not on the show, but you say, hey, can I get a guest set? And that's where they say, we have a special guest tonight. And you show up and you do 5 minutes or whatever. I just wish more clubs would just do away with it altogether, because it's rare that it ever helps a show. And I'm not saying it as well, how are these comics ever going to get better? They get better on their own at open mics and other places like that. I just sort of feel like the guest set is for the headliner to say, hey, my friend's in town. He's not working this club. Why don't you take a look at him? I'll give him a guest set. But if you already work a club, if that's already your home club, doing a guest set there doesn't help you. It oversaturates you. It means that the next time that those patrons come to see a show and you're actually on the show, there's a good chance they'll have seen some of your material. And the other thing is, it just doesn't help the show. It doesn't always hurt the show, but it's not helping the show at all. It's just 5 minutes and it's kind of like a jolt. I feel like this thing's been worked out for hundreds of years as far as the opener, middle, and closer. And by hundreds of years, I mean 20 or 30. But I think the thing is that a lot of times guest sets are less than. They're not as good as the other comics that are already on the show. And so even if the MC's really good, a guest set can bring that energy back down. If the guest set's better than the MC, then it can help the show. But that's rare. So I guess my only piece of advice is let's think differently about the guest set in terms of being something that, let's call it the gift set. That's my new terminology. It should be something that somebody gifts to you, and you don't go around asking for gifts. So it will be more special when somebody gifts it to you than if you ask for it and they say, okay, or even no. Yeah, I guess that's just my own little thing. If you're not a comic and you don't understand what I'm talking about, I guess the closest real world translation would be, if you like soccer or you like baseball or whatever, and you have a friend who's on a team and you're always asking if you can play with the team, but it's obvious when you get out there to play with the team that you're not as good as everybody else. Or maybe you are just as good as everybody else, but you kind of mess up the rhythm of the game because they're used to playing with each other and you only come in every 6 weeks or so to play because you kind of like to, but you're too busy. It just throws things off a little bit. But I don't think that that's always the case. I just think that that is becoming more often the case. And I think a lot of newer comics, I'm not talking to people that have been doing it for years, I think they probably get it, but newer comics think of it as just another chance to get on stage and get better and show the crowd or show somebody that they're, it just, it's not, you're not. Managers aren't watching the guest set if the headliner didn't ask you to do it. And if you're already working that club, like I said, you're just oversaturating yourself. That being said, let's get into the podcast. Today's guest is Joe Young. He's a good friend of mine. I've kind of taken him under my wing, and by under my wing, not really, just told, just a voice of advice or point of, hey, do you like this idea? He does a little bit of artwork for me here and there, and I give him a few pointers here and there. We're supposed to do a show here in October together. And so my desire to help him is not altruistic. It is so that he can succeed at this show. But my object in putting him on the show was to give him a kind of a deadline to have a certain amount of material and to have it be good enough. And I think that if you don't have those types of deadlines, like a show that requires more time out of you than you've ever done, and a paid audience, whatever. It's just like a big opportunity. Without those big opportunities and enough time to prepare for them, you could spend years preparing for an opportunity that hasn't come yet. So the more opportunities you have, the more opportunities you have to prepare for said opportunities. With that, I give you Joe Young.
Sound.
to me, there needs to always be some sort of kind of amp, even if it's just a hum.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's get into the podcast. How long have you been doing comedy?
It'll be a year next week.
Oh, wow. You're like right on that that angle. So how many podcasts have you done since you started doing comedy?
This is my second one.
Okay. And I feel like I'm getting you early then. So hopefully the tens of people that are fans of your comedy and the tens of people that listen to the podcast will learn something about you today. What have you learned in the first year? What's the biggest realization since you started doing comedy?
Being okay with failing.
Yeah.
I don't know if being okay is the right term, but accepting it, learning from it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I think there's varying degrees of being okay with anything. Because failure is not something that you get to have a say in, usually.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, I know some people that are really miserable with failure, but I know people that are really miserable with success as well.
Well, I still get miserable, but it's getting easier. This is the only hobby or job, whatever you call it, where you have to constantly fail in front of people. Like, you can learn an instrument, but you practice at home by yourself, and then you get better, and then you go public. This is no, you got to do it in front right away.
Yeah.
You have to show it off.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. I think I had a joke once. It was a Facebook post where I said, new jokes are like a girlfriend or a new girl that you're dating. You know, it's really exciting in the beginning. You can't wait to take her to the club, only to find out that all of your friends have already done her. That's probably too wordy. But it's one of those situations where, yeah, you're right, failure is one of the biggest learning metrics, but it's also one of those things that doesn't necessarily, there's two schools of thought. Like, you have to fail in order to be successful, and there's other people like, no, you don't ever have to fail. To be successful, you can just be good all the time. But comedy, so much of it is, I mean, to say 50% of it was up to you would be generous. It's really probably about 20%. And if you're really, really, really talented, where the audience came to see you specifically because you're famous and you're known for, then you could probably say it's a little bit more than 50. But for the average comic, you're stepping into a poker game. These are the cards you've been dealt, and you've got to make the best hand out of it.
Yeah.
But when you're first starting, it's almost like I'm just trying to figure out what hands win in poker.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're like, I'm just like, okay, do I have two pair here, or is this a straight? Because I don't know if I should be trying to make a full house. Should I draw?
I'm still learning the rules.
It's, and it's one of those things that you never fully learn. I mean, like, I'm speaking to you like some sage old shaman, but I mean, there's all kinds of stuff I'm still fucking learning every day. And I think that knowing that that's how the trip is, that there's always something you can learn,
yeah,
or a trick you can pull out, that because you've learned so many, it's a gathering of those things.
Well, and it's not like an instrument where you learn the song and then it's a perfect song and then you just do it and you're done. You have to keep changing and doing new things and learning. If you stop wanting to learn, then you should just stop.
Yeah, I feel that way too, and I think there's varying opinions on that matter, but I think for me, the biggest thing that I'm dealing with even today is how much of what I thought, there's a lot of unknowns in comedy. You don't know how your career is going to go. You don't know how, what next year is going to look like compared to this year. And I think a lot of what I didn't know was, that's in my memory bank, started from before I started doing comedy. And since you're a little bit closer to that spectrum, so what I'm saying is, like, before you started, you had an idea of what it would be like to be a comedian.
Yeah.
What's the biggest, other than the failure aspect of it, what's the biggest realization that you've seen?
Oh, man, I don't really know. I feel like I had a pretty good idea of what it was before I started. I think that's why I started. Yeah. I watched a lot of documentaries, like I Am Road Comic, I Am Comic, and I kind of got the gritty feel to it. You know, there's no money, it's depressing, it's lonely, it's hard.
Yeah.
And I had that going in before I started, so it wasn't too jolting.
I can honestly say that, you know, without, have you ever seen Comedian?
No, not yet.
With Jerry Seinfeld? Dude, no. I should stop this podcast and start re-recording after you've seen it, because it's better than almost all of them in that it's Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And who's bigger than him, right? And it kind of shows him having a hard time at it at times. And then it shows this other guy, Orny Adams, who's a great comic, but they kind of show his neurotic side of just getting, like, into this new breakout phase of his career. It's really eye-opening, but that didn't exist for me until after I started, but it was there. And I think the internet makes those things easier to get, but I definitely know that the time between my first open mic and, like, my second open mic, or, like, the time between I first tried comedy and when I started doing comedy, the biggest difference was there was a year and a half in between, but the biggest thing that gave me the most was meeting comedians and seeing I Am Comic. And a lot of comedians will say things like, oh yeah, and you read the comedy Bible too. It's like, well yeah, everybody does that. And it's kind of a hack thing to say, I got into comedy because I saw this documentary or whatever. It does a lot, and it does very little at the same time. And I would say this about it. If you watched any of those documentaries, Heckler by Jamie Kennedy, or any of those, if you watched them and thought at the end of it, like, yeah, no, I get it, but I'd still like to try it. Like, if that's where you're at with it, then you're truly probably supposed to try it. Because most people's aversion to comedy starts with, I don't know how you guys do that. I've always wanted to do that, but I don't know how you get up there and actually do it. And it's like, I didn't know how I actually got up there and did it until I actually walked my legs up there and did it. And yeah. Then once I did that for the first time, I knew it's going to be easier to do this every time.
Yeah. And it's like, if you don't watch those, you don't have any idea. Like, there's the people who do one open mic and then ask for money. Mm-hmm. But then you watch, like, I Am Road Comic, and these guys have been, you know, 10, 15 years, and they're budgeting their food for the week. Oh, we can't spend this money because, you know, we overhead. And it's like, no, there's no money in this. You do it because you have to or you love it.
Yeah, and I think there's also other ways to make the road pay, but most people aren't willing to do that much work. I think there's a certain, I don't know that it's incorrect, but there's a certain entitlement idea that, like, well, I'm the talent, you know, and I should be getting paid, and I should get a hotel, and I don't want to have to, like, who's taking care of all of this? This isn't showbiz, and it's very much showbiz, but it's not glitz and glamour. It's, you got to be in charge of your own shit, you know what I mean? And like, and the difference between last year and this year, as far as like the quality of hotels that I've stayed in, I would have thought would have gone up tremendously, but it's pretty much stayed constant the whole time, because that's something I've always sought out, you know what I mean? Like, there's been certain venues or bookers or whatever, or situations that I've got myself into where I'm like, I'll get my own hotel, you know what I mean? Because it's that important to me to sleep well.
Okay.
And I got really lucky starting out that it just wasn't. But I think before I started, I thought, like, I would have been robbed in a motel room and would have seen a lot more street prostitution. But I haven't seen any of that.
Oh.
You know what I mean? It's been a pretty positive experience so far. Like, everything, like, the worst motel that I've ever been to was just a couple of weeks ago. And it was literally, like, the first time they'd ever done comedy. So I was like a guinea pig. I was like, okay, I can take this two ways. I can be honored that I'm the first comedian to be here, or I can be horrified that anybody would think this is the kind of accommodation I'd ever stay in.
What was bad about it?
Imagine we're back here, but somebody just put a roof up and then roughed in a bathroom in that corner there, but like the bucket was the toilet with the pole still in it, and it just was like, it was like two separate sides of construction. It was like the room where the bed was. It's just, God, I don't even know. Let's put it this way. If I could name the motel, I would call it Motel Fallujah.
Oh, my gosh.
Or maybe Abu Ghraib of Northern Michigan. Yeah. Or something like that.
Did you take pictures?
I was going to, but the thing about that right there is I'm an ambassador in that situation.
Okay.
For the agency that I'm working for.
Okay.
And I've seen comedians, right, wrong, or indifferent, I've seen comedians have opinions about places that they've played, and somebody's always watching, you know what I mean? So it's one of those situations where it's like, I know, they called me, which is something they don't normally do, they called me and asked me if everything was okay, and I gave them my honest assessment, you know, it wasn't like, but I call myself a road warrior, which means I'm equipped. If I had to sleep in my car, I would have slept in my car. You know what I mean? So it's not like I'm some diva. Like, the headliner stayed. And I don't even, like, know how.
You didn't stay.
I didn't stay. No, yeah. I got my own hotel. I got my own hotel up the road. It was about 20 miles away. And I would have just drove back, but it was, like, literally 6 hours away. And it was also one of those kinds of gigs where, like, it paid enough to do it, but it was a one-nighter, and it was out of the way. And at the time that I booked it, I was really happy to have it. But at the time it came time to do it, it was kind of like, hey, if this gets canceled, even though I've driven out here. But it ended up being a great show.
That's good.
The only downside being I didn't sell any merch. So anytime you have to pick up your own hotel after the fact, the idea would be hopefully I make up for it in selling shirts. But in a place that's doing comedy for the first time, typically, unless you're a hell of a salesman or both the comics are really lay down like a foundation for a pitch that touches, moves, and inspires the audience, you're not selling anything. It's like a break-in period for audiences. After they've been to several shows, then they feel comfortable buying merch because they're like, oh, it's not just this one guy. They all do this.
Uh-huh.
They all have, and I'd like to take a piece of this show. This guy was actually really funny. But then sometimes you do like a really shitty show, and that's where you sell the most merch. And you do a really killer show, and you don't sell any merch.
Huh.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there. I feel like I'm doing a really good job of what I call Bert Kreischering the podcast, where I have a guest and then I do all the talking. So, tell me about your first. How long did you were you writing, thinking about doing comedy, telling people you were doing? Did you tell people you wanted to be a comic?
Well, I wanted to be a comic like 8 years ago, and I told everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing jokes, mm-hmm. And then something, I don't know what changed my mind, but I just didn't do it.
What do you mean you don't know what changed your mind?
I can't pinpoint it down to why I didn't try it then.
Had you done research? So the hardest piece of research, other than doing joke writing or reading a book or watching a movie, is finding the open mic. Did you find an open mic?
No. I knew that Wiley's had one, and that was it.
You never went and saw it?
Never went and saw it, no.
Eight years ago. How old are you?
28.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
For those of you guys, I have to put a picture of him up, but he looks like he's 8 years older than me. And he's 12 years younger than me. Okay, go ahead.
So then one thing led to another. I met my wife, things happened, and just life went on. And then,
you met your wife after, did you tell your wife you wanted to be a comedian?
Yeah, we did. We had talked about it. It was one of those things, you know, you just, ask each other questions, if money wasn't an option and you were good at what you wanted to do tomorrow, what would it be?
Yeah.
Mine was stand-up comic.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was just one of those things. So then it's just one of those things people keep telling you, you know, you should do comedy. And in my head, I'm thinking, well, I'm funny in conversation, but how do you translate that to a joke, you know, that everybody can understand? And then I just started thinking a little bit. I probably wrote about 3 months before I went up. Probably about for 3 months before I went up last year.
Huh. And then I'm more fascinated about the time in between you starting and thinking you wanted to start. What was the thing that had you start telling people? What was the idea behind that?
Well, I think I just had a group of friends that, you know, kept telling me this was...
Were any of them comics?
No.
Any of them know any comics?
No.
Okay.
I knew no one in comedy until I started last year.
Yeah, me
either. But 8 years ago, I told everybody I was going to do it. I didn't do it. So when I did do it last year, the only person I told was my wife.
Uh-huh.
I said, I'm going to do this tonight. And she said, okay, go do it. And then after I did it, I was like, I did it for me.
Uh-huh.
And then now I can tell everybody.
Yeah. That's very similar to my situation, too. Except I did tell my best friend, Dave Scott, and I told a girl I worked with, Tia Collins, who I want to have on the podcast. And she's the one that actually told me about the open mic. I was working at Donato's in Springfield. I was the general manager on Limestone. And so I didn't want my fiancé or anybody to be there. I didn't want anyone to be there, but I wanted Tia to be there kind of because she was like a karaoke singer. She was a singer, but she was like, I felt like as a performer, she got it. She would get it. And I wanted somebody to be able to hit like the record button. So she was going to record, but she couldn't figure out the camera at the last second or whatever. And at the last minute, my buddy shows up with his fiance. And I told him like once a month before it happened. But he remembered and still showed up. And he was able to get the camera working. I've since lost that recording. It might be like on a computer that I have. You know, like you like throw a computer away, but it just means you put it in the closet.
Yeah,
it might be on one of those. But I've tried to find it. I can't find it
anywhere. Where was it at?
It was at this Holiday Inn in Springfield.
Oh.
on Leffels Lane, and Dave Glarden was the guy that put it on. Dave Glarden was the first comic that the first person I ever contacted about getting on stage.
Okay.
And he got back to me like within 5 minutes.
Wow.
And gave me a date. And it was literally like the happiest day of my life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, it was all meant to be. Like, that day was the first day that our store had the internet. Like, we had internet before, but it was like intranet. And like, this was us being like able, and the only thing we could use was the Weather Channel and the Dayton Daily News website and the Donato's website. Those are the only three websites, and I got the information I needed off of the Dayton Daily News website, which had a portal to Yahoo, which was my email. It was like perfect, right? It's like, hey, email me right back. And it was, the article was in the Dayton Daily News. They were talking about an open mic that had happened in Springfield that their friend had done at work. And I'm like looking at him like, what the? You guys know I want to do comedy. And they're like, oh, God, yeah, Adrian, you should look it up. It's at the Holiday Inn or whatever. I went right back to the office, about in 5 minutes, emailed the guy, I want to do comedy. Okay, emailed back, yeah, do comedy. And I'm like, ah! I was like, and I just remember, like, leading up to that being, like, the happiest. And so the first time I went up, it went pretty well.
Yeah.
And I met Dan Swartout and Gary Offal. And there might have been somebody else there that is, that I should know or remember, but those were the only two guys I remember. And they were both very friendly. And Dan Swartout came up to me after my set, and he was like, you should stick with it. Was that really your first time? You should really you got talent, you know, kind of a thing. And I didn't believe him to be a comic at all, because he was talking about how he had been on the road but wasn't making any money. So now he came back home, and he's just doing these local gigs and stuff, and he's happier. And I was just like, it sounds like a failure story. But then, like, at the end of the show, he goes up and he headlines, and it was clearly, like, the difference between, like, we were mice and he was a man, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
we were trying to do comedy, he did comedy. I mean, the whole place was pretty gracious, but when he went up, you would have thought it was, you know, Caroline's. I mean, you would have just thought it was like a real comedy club, because he was just destroying the room. And that's what I realized, like, recently, is that in the audience only knows, it's like David Copperfield is just as amazing as a 14-year-old magician if you haven't seen magic in a while. Whatever you put in front of the audience is what they'll appreciate. You know what I mean? So, like, it's important that a guy who's marginally funny opens for a guy who's extremely funny. Because if the guy who's extremely funny goes up, it's going to be very hard for the marginally funny guy to follow or entertain the audience after a certain point. It's almost like, you know, if the first adult magazine you ever saw was Penthouse, Playboy looks like Maxim.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, what is this? This is nothing. It's like, I don't even see a schlong on a shoulder. There's no soap. What? The point is, that was my first experience in understanding that what I was doing was completely different than what was expected of me if I was going to be a real comedian. And I think that kind of scared me. And the next time I did comedy, I didn't, and this for this either, maybe I wrote a line or two. If I wrote a line or two, like, it was about my closing bit, which was about porta potties, which is essentially like a very, it was kind of like a animated shit joke, but where I'm eating shit though, so it's classy.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
And I never have repeated any of those jokes. And then I did another set a couple weeks later, bombed my ass off, like literally the week I was going to get married, in front of all of my friends. And they were the only people that came there, and they were like not even paying, they're like playing darts while I was on stage and stuff. It was just not so. But what was good about that was that, like, some of my closest friends got to see me at the lowest point I've ever been in my life. But I didn't do comedy for like almost 2 years, and then I did Wiley's open mic with Karen Jaffe was the first person that got me into that. And after that, that's what I really considered like my start of comedy, because that's when I started doing comedy.
Oh, so you took 2 years off.
After my first open mic. But I think even before I started doing comedy, I was telling people that I was a comic or wanted to be a comic. I think after I did those open mics, I started telling people I was a comedian.
Uh-huh.
Knowing that in the loosest sense possible, I was able to call myself that, but in reality, I wasn't. And I had one friend, Matt, who was always like asking me when I was going to do another date, when I was going to get, and because he wanted to come see. And if it wasn't for that, you know, him, like, he was probably the only one. When are you going to do that again? I would like to come see. Yeah, I don't know that I ever would have really found it, but it was Travis Clyburn's improv class at the Rosewood Center in Kettering that I found on Facebook, after I'd had knee surgery, I just saw this post said Rosewood Arts Center has improv classes or whatever, and I saw, called, signed up, missed the first two classes because I was on crutches and I was nervous about going. But on that third class, I actually went, and I met Travis Clyburn and Brock Shank and Dave Brinkman, Nathan Hall, Karen Jaffe eventually, a veritable who's who, Jonathan Craig. I mean, I met a lot of guys, Doug Morgan, through that improv process. But through that improv process, I also got turned on to the fact that everybody that was doing it was already a comic. And so I got tuned into where all the local comedy shows were going, and it was literally like getting into Fight Club. Like, there's a Fight Club in my neighborhood? You know what I mean? Like, you don't know how much comedy's happening if you're not in comedy.
Yeah, I guess there's that's our fault. We're not very good at marketing.
Well, no, it's not that. It's that our friends and family, by, like, unfortunately, some now have an idea how much comedy's actually happening locally. But it's the same reason you don't know where the next remote control helicopter competition is. Because you're not really supposed to.
Okay.
That's not really your thing.
Yeah.
And if you did, you'd find it quickly. But I saw a remote control helicopter competition, and I couldn't help but draw every single parallel to stand-up comedy.
Huh.
Everybody knew who the best was. You know what I mean? I couldn't tell the difference.
Okay.
But everybody else knew who the best was, and you could kind of see it in the quality of the helicopter. So what I equated that to was polish. What I couldn't understand was, these guys open strong and dwindle out because their batteries are strongest when they start.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Okay, so it's not like they have this big closer because they could stall out and wreck their helicopter or whatever. So they start strong and then kind of goes into more like dancey tricks or whatever at the end. But I was like, oh, no, you got to start small and big. You know, and I started realizing like, oh, there's a whole different dynamic to this thing that you appreciate the nuance. It's almost like ballet. It's like if I were to go like, oh, this ballet's crap. What the fuck do I know about ballet? I don't know anything. So when I noticed when I first started doing open mics, my friends and family would come out and they'd be like, oh, that guy was really funny. I'm like, those were all street jokes. And they'd be like, oh, you're not allowed to do that? You should do some of those. And I'm like, it's different what I'm doing. I'm thinking of these. I got those out of a book. And they're like, oh, well, I don't know who you were. Maybe you're supposed to do that because he was really funny. You know how they were laughing when he was on stage, and when you were on stage, they were just kind of, like, they're looking. They're smiling sometimes. What was your first set like?
Good. It was really good. I think it's because I had no expectations. So I didn't really... And it was all Dayton Comics. There was no real people there. It was a hole in the wall.
So was your first open mic the first time you'd ever been to an open mic?
Yes.
At Wiley's?
No, it was a hole in the wall.
Oh, that's right. You just said that. Who put you up?
Mike Holinsky put me up first. So he opened the show, and then
So take me back. You walk in to Hole in the Wall. You know what's happening because why?
Dan Seabury. I made a comment on Reddit, on the Dayton subreddit, about comedy. Here I am. It's ticking in my head. I got to find out more about it. He messages me. He's like, hey, there's this group, Dayton Comics Facebook group. You know, join it, and you'll find out about the shows. So, okay. So then about 3 months went by after that, and I'm hearing about these shows on there, and I'm seeing them, and I'm like, okay, let me try it. I was like, I see Hole in the Wall. I was like, all right, we're doing it.
Sounds like a great place to start my comedy career.
I didn't know. Yeah. And I didn't want my first time to be a bringer show. I didn't want anybody else to see me.
Yeah, like I said,
for me. So, yeah, I go in and I introduce myself to Mike and tell him it's my first
How
time.
Early did... What time did the show start? What time did you get there?
Oh, man. I think it started at 10. I got there at, like, 9.
Okay.
I was so nervous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I just read my notes
Did you
the
throw
whole time.
Up or anything?
No, okay. Didn't throw up.
Has that ever happened for you?
No.
Okay.
No. Just
from being drunk?
No. Oh, I mean...
Like drinking and then throwing up? Like, do you have a gag? Will you throw up eventually?
Yeah,
okay, all right, cool. I just want, so you're the one who's never thrown up. Even as a baby, I kept it all inside. Shit it out later, whatever.
It's so big, it's all puke.
So you get there an hour early.
Yeah.
You introduce yourself to Mike Holinsky, who, if you don't know Mike Holinsky, who I should have on the podcast before he moves an hour away.
He already moved.
Oh, fuck. Well, I think I can find him in Cincinnati. He's weird, but was he weird for you just meeting him?
No, I didn't.
Not weird in a bad way.
I was
like
so
weird
nervous.
In the best
I didn't
way.
Talk to anybody. I just see this guy setting everything up, and I was so intimidated.
You see a young Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, and then he starts talking. He does his set, and I was like, oh, I really like this guy. He's really funny, and it made me a little more calm. And then everybody stayed in the room. Everybody watched me. I think there's maybe 15 comics.
You went first?
Yeah,
After him, he opened up. Okay.
Yeah, and they all stayed and watched me. I got a lot of compliments afterwards. Yeah, it was great. And then my second time was awful.
Yeah, that's how mine was, too.
Yeah.
How quickly did you get back on the horse after? And what made the second time so bad? Let's back up.
It was, let's see, Hole in the Wall was on a Tuesday. The following Monday, I did Dublin Pub open mic.
Oh, yeah.
So, right.
No, that's not going to be good ever.
No,
really.
And yeah. I just, my friend was there. I told my friend, he came, and he was recording me. I think that was in the back of my head.
Yeah.
I was drinking a lot. I was very drunk. Very sweaty and hot, and I had a panic attack. I couldn't breathe.
Yeah,
I was trying to read my jokes and I couldn't breathe, and I'm just trying
on
to get
on stage.
Through. Yeah, like, oh yeah.
Nice. And do you have that on tape?
I think I deleted it.
Dude, you're gonna want that one day.
I don't know, man.
You're gonna want that one day.
I was researching for a week after that. I think I still have a bookmark on my phone of how to breathe on stage. And
like, through your eyelids.
I'm asking these people, how do you breathe on stage? How do you deal with these panic attacks? Like, does it just get better? And I was just like, maybe this isn't for me. And I can't remember the time I went up after that. It was very soon. I was like, I just got it. Actually, it was the next night. Dan messaged me, Dan Seabree, and he's like, hey, somebody dropped out of Super Dope at Feathers. Do you want a spot? And I was like, did you see me last night? I said, I was awful. I was like, you don't want me to. He's like, no, it's fine. Because he didn't see me.
Yeah.
He just
but do you think
me.
That would have made a difference?
No, he still would have given me a chance. Mm-hmm. And
that's
just,
what's great about Dan is he would have been like, dude, yeah, no, it's supposed to suck.
Yeah.
It's supposed to suck most of the
it's
time.
It's like just, and I don't know what would have happened if he wouldn't have given me that chance because I was really beating myself up after that.
Yeah.
And I did the show at Feathers, bombed again really bad, still having problems breathing, but just slowly it just got better. I never did well at Dublin Pub, ever.
Yeah.
I
never did that show.
It was
show
always in my head that was going to happen again and I could never get it out.
I never did that show, not because I heard it was bad or anything. I just, yeah, I think by the time I got around to, like, thinking, oh, maybe I should try that, it, like, got canceled or whatever. But
yeah.
I was amazed by the Super Dope show that I did being just phenomenally good for being in a garage and cold.
Yeah.
And I think, like, part of my misery helped me do well that night because I was, like, freezing cold and I had a down jacket in my trunk. But I just didn't go get it. Like, I didn't look. I was like, oh, it's not in there. I thought, maybe it's in there, but I was like, no, it's not in there. Then the next time I thought I needed a jacket, I went and looked, and it was in there. So I knew it was in there for then, too. I was like, it's been in there. I haven't had it all winter. It's been in there just in case I had an emergency. If I had put that jacket on, I would have been comfortable the whole night.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have that jacket, I'm literally, like, wrapped up in an OU, like, it looks like a grill cover. You know what I mean? I was like, like, by the fire, I smell like a green fire, which is not something anybody ever wants to smell like. And then I went up and I did, you know, I was only supposed to do 15. I think I did 17 minutes. And it wasn't, like, earth-shattering, right? It wasn't the fantastic. But I told a story I'd never told on stage before. A couple. And I never felt more part of, like, a community that I think I was intimidated by, which I would say that's kind of more of, like, the alti scene.
Uh-huh.
At least the alti scene in this area.
Yeah.
But I was very well-received. And it was fun. Like, at the end of it, I was like, you know, this is what I miss about comedy was, like, the first 2 years probably the best time you're going to have, at least in recent memory. There'll be other times that you have where you're hanging out with, like, your hero, your celebrity friends or whatever, or that you, like, that you looked up to when you started. I imagine that's never happened for me. No, it definitely has. But it's fleeting because the people that you start with, like, the people that you start with are the people that you have the most love for, period. And, like, having success with them is what I think has the most lasting memory because you're being imprinted right now. This is like you're just figuring out how to masturbate and kiss a girl. And eventually you learn how to make love and you forget how much fun it was just to fucking hold hands with a girl.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, you kind of
have
to
embrace.
That's
what you did the whole thing for.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
to bring it all the way back around.
So you don't think that was earth-shattering because I heard otherwise. I heard you murdered that room.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, that's humbling. That's it was fun, but it was also one of those things where everybody did really well, and I was really surprised. In fact, I really want a copy of that whole show because I feel like everybody should be making a copy of that CD and taking it whenever they have an opportunity to sell something at a show or whatever. I'm not saying that that's a CD that's worth $10 or it's worth $20 or whatever, but it's a CD that's worth, hey, if you like me, if you'll like my friends, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and that's something
yeah.
I feel like I could easily do at the end of a show with my T-shirts or whatever, is have a copy of that, hey, because that's all I do for my T-shirts 90% of the time, too, is, like, you know, whatever. They cost me about $5, but you can give me whatever you want. You can give me whatever you want for this t-shirt. I've taken literally a dollar for a t-shirt before. Once. And it wasn't... at the end of the day, it's like I'm not selling the t-shirts to get rich. You know what I mean? Like, the t-shirts, I think at the time that I still did that, it was my podcast t-shirt, which, little secret, I'd give those away. You know what I mean? If I could. You know, if I thought somebody was going to wear it around or whatever, enjoy it. Yeah, because it's just got my podcast on it. It's just free advertising for me. I mean, I spent the most money on one single shipment of t-shirts for the one shirt that I knew I didn't need to make any money on. Okay. Because that's the one I'm going to be like, oh, if you're a fan of the podcast, please take this shirt because I know you'll like it.
Yeah.
And it's good to have something like that in merch. And that's how I feel about that CD. If you liked my set tonight, then you'll hear some stuff I've never told before on stage. And you'll definitely like these guys. Because I felt like, wow, everybody here is really doing well.
Yeah.
Guys that I normally think have a hard time with it did really well. And it's nice to see a guy that you see have a hard time with it from time to time have that look on his face like the guy who never gets laid walking out of a gangbang. Like, yeah, we did it, huh, fellas? Like, high-fiving everybody. I don't know. That's probably a really bad analogy. But it's good to see... It's good to be a part of the community when everybody's doing well, because then it makes it a lot easier to say, oh, Adrian murdered him.
Yeah.
If everybody else had a rough time and I did okay, people would be like, yeah, he did okay. But when everybody's doing really well, you can big up, you know, oh,
yeah.
You know, everybody was crushing it. That's easy to say, because it was. And I think there's something to that magic, you know, the home show. I've done a couple home shows like that before home shows were a thing.
Uh-huh.
But they're definitely becoming a thing.
Yeah, they are. And it works.
You did one in a black home.
I did.
I mean black, like the home wasn't painted black. It was an African-American's home.
Yes.
And most of the guests were African-American?
All but one and me were African-American.
Who was the other? Was it a guest or a comic?
It was a guest. It was a friend of Keith's. I think her name's Jenny, but that was it. Just us two.
And what was the learning lesson there for you?
I wish I would have learned something, but I just did my... I guess I did. So I had this... notion that I was going to do terribly.
Yeah.
You know, because these people aren't like me.
These people.
I'm not like them.
Let the record state.
The audience is not like me. I am not like
Six
them.
Six of these Negroes are doing their own thing.
So I had this I just had this idea in my head, it's going to go awful. And so I went on stage the whole time throughout the show. I'm looking around this house and I'm thinking of all these little things. I'm texting my friends these jokes. It's like, how does this sound? Is this all right? And they're like, oh, you should do it. I was like, I don't know. And then I went up there, and I did something I've never done before, and I went, like, 3 or 4 minutes off book, which I never do, which I should, you know. But normally I just do my jokes and my set that I've arranged, and that's it. But this, I just went up, and I roasted the house, I guess you would say.
Uh-huh.
I roasted Keith, just off-the-cuff things that I thought of 5 minutes beforehand. Uh-huh. And it went better than anything else I've ever done.
Uh-huh.
And it was, if I could learn how to do that more, that would be great. But someone came up to me after the show, and she said, you were naturally funny. And I've never felt like I have been like that on stage. Mm-hmm. And that was the best compliment I've ever gotten.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredible.
Is that, you're naturally funny? Is that like, do you think that's going to be like your recurring, like, you know what, if you really want to get my attention, tell me I'm naturally funny.
There's two things. Ahead. There's that one. And then my friend told me once, after a set at the Funny Bone, he said, you made me laugh very hard, but I didn't want to. Like, and that was probably better. That's
yeah.
how I feel better, because that's my goal. It's
yeah.
like the edge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's not funny, but oh, God, I got to laugh at that.
Yeah, I don't want to laugh at that,
yeah.
but I have to.
Yeah.
That's interesting, too. Yeah, for me, what it is when an audience member says to me, like, if they just point at their head, like, tap their cranium with their forefinger, or if they're even just saying it was too smart for the room. To me, just the acknowledgement that I'm intelligent is enough for me to be like, oh, thank you very much. Oh, thank you. Like, does it make a bad set good?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I had that happen to me recently at a casino where the last guy out of the room was like, I think you were just a little over their heads. I enjoyed it.
Huh.
And what I realized at the end of that all was, the lesson for me in that set was, I could have just sat back and avoided the whole room exiting. But I went and shook hands. I had a t-shirt that I went up on stage with, didn't pitch it.
Yeah.
Because it was just like, it wasn't like, I even said at one point, I understand this isn't going well. Neither one of us, or both of us thought this was going to go a lot better than it is.
Yeah.
And that got a big laugh. And that's when if that gets the big laugh, and you know you're not really going to recover very well from that. And but at the end of it, I was like, you know, I could go retreat, or I could go shake everybody's hand, you know, or at least attempt to. And I stood there, and everybody shook my hand. I mean, like, it was mostly what I realized at the end of it. They were all over 60. I mean, like, maybe there was a couple people there that were under 50, but 90% of them were over 60. And they all said, thank you very much. We really enjoyed the show. Thank you very much. We really enjoyed the show. And I was thinking to myself, like, whether that's true or not,
yeah.
They didn't have to stop. They could have walked around the line of people shaking my hand, and I was the only dude standing there. The headliner didn't. He had a rough time of it, too. And that was the only time. I wasn't rooting for him to do poorly at all, but it was kind of like, oh, thank God it's not just me. Okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that that's sort of the, I don't know, I've always wanted to see my peers do well, but I definitely know that when I started, there was a lot of animosity when somebody was way better than everybody else, or like where five guys struggled and one guy did really well, but he's like started at the same time as us. Like, how's he doing so well?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's natural. I mean, you get a little jealous, and it's just, if you let it take control, that's when it's bad, but
yeah.
I think it's normal to get a tiny bit jealous, like, oh, I wasn't that good when I started, but...
Yeah, when I think there's also two types of jealousy. I mean, there's jealousy that comes... Well, no, we'll say the spectrum of jealousy is a wide one, right? Because on one side you have, like, the negative jealousy, and you have, like, motivational jealousy.
Yeah,
demotivational, yeah. And motivational jealousy, we'll say. And, for instance, I have a very close friend who just got the news of a lifetime in his career, and I knew that this would always happen for him. Right, but he had to sit back and watch some of us get opportunities that he should have gotten, but didn't get them for whatever reason, you know?
Okay.
And so he's like, man, I can't wait till I get my chance. He was just saying this to me like a couple weeks ago. I can't wait till I get my chance to do that. I can't wait till I get my chance to be there or whatever. And I'm like, man, dude, when you get your chance at whatever this game has to offer, it's going to leapfrog all of us. And sure enough, a couple weeks later, he gets this opportunity, and it leapfrogs everything any of us have ever done.
Oh.
And then, like... the mana that rains down from the gods when you get a big opportunity was greater than anything anybody I know has ever experienced.
Oh.
And it's like, it's all still really, really secret. So you'd have to be like, you'd have to really, really know to know anything. But, let's just say, one of my best friends he's about to blow up.
Yeah.
And that's the best part of it because like he was really, a big cheerleader for me when I got my opportunity. And I can't wait to be a big cheerleader for him. Like, I'm jealous, but not in the sense of, why can't I have that? It's more like, it's like, if he can get it, we can all get it. I'm not one of these people that thinks there's a scarcity in comedy. Some people have this, like, well, you're taking away opportunities from me. There's just too many opportunities and mm-hmm. too many people not really trying very hard. So obvious.
Yeah.
It's so obvious that all you have to do is try a little bit harder than the guy who's trying the least hard, and you'll stand out. At least that's, I'm not going to say that's my secret to success, because I have very little success, but it's obvious to me.
There's always going to be somebody trying harder than you. You just have to keep trying.
Yeah. Or lack of trying
is
probably most comedians' cross that they carry through the desert. And this idea that like the comedian lifestyle is a lazy one. You know,
because
to me, when I was before comedy, I did poker, and I played my best poker when I had a full-time job.
Yeah.
Like, because it was such a release from the full-time job. It was like, now I'm on vacation at the end of every day. I'm playing online or going to a game. And I didn't really have that with comedy because I started going back to school the same time I started doing comedy. But when you go to a comedy show, do you feel like you're, like, at this different world? Than your job?
Oh, absolutely.
What do you do for a job?
Like I have two lives. I work at a hospital. I just deliver food to patients.
Okay, and then...
And so I work, you know, like 6 to 3.
Uh-huh.
I go home. I usually take a nap.
6
a.m.
to 3 p.m.
To 3 p.m.
You don't like switch shifts?
No, okay. No. So then I'll go home. Usually I'll take a nap of some sorts. And then I'll wake up and it's like a new day has started.
I'll
do comedy. I'll come home around midnight or 1. Go back to sleep. Just do part 1 again. It's just...
I could totally fit your schedule into my life, really, because, like, the between 6 and 3 is, like... Well, my day's a little bit different, but, like, I'll usually get up around 5 or 6, and then I'll do whatever it is I'm going to do that's, like, important. Like, if it's the podcast, I try to get that done in the morning. And then around 9 or 10, I'll, like, make breakfast. And then I'll probably take a shower or something like that and then take a nap until noon. And then I wake up at noon or 1 or 2 or whatever, depending on how tired I am from the night before. But I almost always wake up at the same time. And that siesta is important to me because it's like you said, it's like 2 days in one.
Yeah.
I like that feeling of, like, waking up because, like, I have a burst of creativity when I wake up in the morning. And then when I wake up from that nap, same thing.
Uh-huh.
And I also have, like, a little bit of creativity right before I'm falling asleep where I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. I almost never write those ideas down. So the exercise has been committing those things to memory so that I wake up with them. And the one thing, I had this idea the other night. I don't remember the joke, but I remember the word. I was like, let me commit this word to memory. The word was application. And I had a whole bit about it.
Okay.
And when I woke up, all I remembered was application. Can't remember the bit.
Oh, see, I always write it down. I always get my phone out and just...
How much of the bit do you write down?
Usually all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, just because I can't trust my memory.
How much, like, do you, like, you're, so if the...
Well, sometimes I'll write, you know, like, I'm working on something now. I won't go too much into it, but I'll say the general idea, and then I'll go so-and-so, and then blah, 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 and I'll know what I meant.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And then go back to and change it.
I wrote on my dry erase board one time, it said, the dude is the... and I saw it, I was like, the dude is the sight? Dude is the shin? I couldn't really see because it was just like, I wrote it so fast because I was like, it was such a like a idea the time that I had it that I was like, there's no way I ever forget this. And and I've gotten confirmation on this idea at times that it's come back into my life and I've told people the bit or whatever and they're like, dude, that really is like your, that's like, and it's like this masterpiece that I've been painting in my mind that I haven't actually put onto canvas yet.
Okay.
That was the first piece of it, though. It was like almost if you like Mona Lisa started with the eyes. These were just the eyes. But it was on there for literally 8 months before I remembered, like, oh, yeah, that's what it says. And it was the last word. It was like, it literally said, the dude is the... what? And I couldn't figure it out. And eventually I remembered what it was the dude is the sign. And what it is a bit about panhandlers and their signs.
Okay.
And a friend of mine not wanting to give money to a panhandler because of what was written on his sign. And he was like, I don't believe that story. And I was like, dude, it's not about the sign. The dude is the sign.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, he's the sign that something's wrong with our society and that something's wrong with him.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's not about the writing on the cardboard. I've only ever told that bit in its entirety to one person, my older sister, and she fell out of her chair laughing. Right?
So why don't you do it more?
Well, because I tried to truncate it, and I did it for my mom, like, a couple days later, and she was like, you know, just nodded her head, and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I see what you did there. Now, my mom is probably the hardest laugh in the world, but all of my comedy is designed to make my mom laugh.
Okay.
So you can see the natural, my sister is my comedy, like, my first comedy partner ever, and then my mom was always like the, like, you can't do that on stage, you can't say that, you know, but my mom's pretty, like, there's nothing, she's not highly sensitive.
So do you run all your bits by her?
No, but it's like when I have a good one, I do. And if I run it, like, so the idea is to run it by my mom without letting her know it's a bit.
Okay.
But she knows, and then she's like, she gives me like a little like, and then I know I can use it. But it's not like it's 100% success. You know, my mom's not a comedian. I gave her a couple books about comedy and because I thought she'd be a great barometer for understanding because she's a great storyteller. But I don't know how much of it interested her. Okay. You know, because she has no desire to go on stage or anything like that. But I think she could probably write a screenplay in her sleep if she wanted to.
Okay.
And she's just that type of person. But I don't, I think I got my comedy from, like, my family, you know, and their experiences. Are you brothers and sisters or anything?
Yeah, I have a little brother, and that's it. That's my only sibling.
How much younger is he?
He's 2.5 years younger.
Does he do any funny stuff?
No. No, we're completely different.
Really?
We're exactly opposite. Yeah, he's very athletic. He was in the Army. He's like 6'3", fit. Yeah.
How tall are you?
5'4".
Nice.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we're completely opposite.
And same dad?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
What's your family think of your comedy career? Like,
I actually don't talk to them, so they don't know. Unless really? They've heard about it through the grapevine, but yeah.
You are estranged from your family?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that something you talk about ever?
No, not really.
Is
no.
it something you choose to keep private?
Yeah, that's my one area. I'm usually pretty private about that. And then, like, I don't really talk about my wife too much unless it's, like, I try to paint her as, like, a character. Uh-huh. So that way, like, because she doesn't come to much of my shows, which is fine.
Yeah.
And I like that because now I can say whatever I want.
Right.
And it's not, like, about a person that mm-hmm. you know. Because, like, a lot of comics will see it and it's, like, they'll prejudge the joke because they know this person.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's just this character, oh, it's my wife, and it's just a thing. And you can, I feel like I have more creativity that way. So,
I
yeah.
can get that.
Yeah, I'm pretty, and like I went on my Facebook, it's all private. Like a lot of that stuff is.
Yeah.
So yeah, I try to kind of cut that off in the beginning just because it's two separate lives. It really is.
I agree to a certain extent, and I think that it's up to everybody to choose which lives they blend together. You know, for me, I typically on Facebook, I don't say this to everybody, but I typically don't follow comedians. Like, I'll be friends with you, but I'll unfollow a lot of times, especially if I don't have a reason. Now, I will go back and follow some people after mm-hmm. I get to know them or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things where you can become oversaturated with your community. And I find that I'm much happier in my Facebook world when it's civilians.
Yeah.
And I can go to the Dayton page if I need my fill of comedy, yuck chucks or whatever like that. But it's like the vast majority of active members on Facebook in my algorithm are comedians.
Okay.
And because the average person is just an observer of Facebook, you know, and comedians are constant contributors to social commentary regardless of the appropriateness of
uh-huh.
So it's just one of those things where I find it easier for me to palate. But I do find that my family has opinions about what I should or shouldn't be talking about on stage, which I don't care.
Yeah.
It's like the only person's opinion that I care about, like what I should or shouldn't be talking about on stage, are other comedians and anybody who books me.
Yeah.
Or anybody who's responsible for answering any questions about what I might have said on stage. Outside of that, and like the comedians, like only my friends, you know what I mean? Or guys that are giving me constructive feedback or whatever like that. But like,
yeah.
To me, it's like a lot of people are like, oh, you should try doing it like this. Oh, will you stand like this? Because we used to do the clash. You asked about this on Facebook. We did the clash and you'd get these feedback cards. There'd be five judges and there'd be scoring you on stage presence and laughs per minute and just different things like that. And then there'd be a room for comments, and those were the most valuable. And one person, in the same contest, one person said, I love the way that you walked around on stage. It looked like you'd been there before. Very natural, very comfortable. And then, like, literally the next card was like, I didn't like the way you walked around on stage all the time. It looked like you didn't know where you were going, and like you were really nervous. And so it's like one of those things where it's like, okay, two people get two totally different interpretations from this activity. The only thing I can do is try to make sure that if I am walking, it's for a reason.
Yeah, okay.
You know, that was the lesson.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But the clash was huge, dude. When I first started, it was like sold out every time. It was once a month, and it would be like 15 or 20 comics, and there'd be guys out on the patio of the Funny Bone like rehearsing their sets, and they'd have their girlfriends there like videotaping them like they're going to be famous one day or whatever. And then those guys don't even get in the show.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Because they didn't bring anybody, and they're just assuming that they're going to... And it was one of those things where I was like, I didn't realize how delusional everybody was. But a contest really does bring out the delusion. You know, because it's always like... And everybody, good or bad, the guys that can win, the guys that can't. It really does bring out, like, how did I not win?
Yeah.
That's one thing I've never been that guy. Even in athletic competition where I felt like I got cheated or whatever. Like, when I played soccer, I was a pretty successful soccer player. So even in those situations, I always just stuck with the result. You know what I mean? Because to me, like, first place... It's not all it's cracked up to be. That's when people start talking shit.
Okay.
You know, like, yeah. Oh, you didn't deserve that or whatever. And I saw that the closest I ever came to winning was I got second in the Titans of the Clash, which is like at the end of the year, all the Clash winners compete against each other. So there's like 12 of us. And Chris Allen won. And I got second, and Matthew David Stanley got third. And then a couple other people that competed thought they should have placed but didn't or whatever, and some people that weren't even in the Titans were like, can you believe Chris won? And I was like, yeah, he told the most jokes, he got the most laughs, he's fucking hilarious. You know what I mean? But it was one of those things where it's like, everybody's interpreting comedy, and it's so subjective that it's like, the last opinion at that same time, I'm saying the only opinions I care about are comics and managers, like the same time, the last opinion I can count on as far as what's funny is a comic that's competing against another comic. So that's the nasty side of competition. But the positive side was it forced us all to get really good. And I think the reason it went away was because at a certain level, some people kept recompeting, which is something I don't agree with. Not that I don't agree with, like, you shouldn't be able to do it. It's just something I would never do. But the argument against that is like, well, get better then if you don't want me to win every time. But bottom line, it forced a lot of people to get better. And then a lot of other people to be like, well, I don't want to do that contest because you can't win. You have to be this, this, or this to win. Bottom line was, if you brought people to the show, like the people that brought the most, got extra points for doing so. You could get in the show having brought no people, but you're going to miss roughly 25 points.
Oh, man.
At the end of it all. So you'd have to overcome a lot to just overcome that 25-point deficit of somebody who brought a lot of people. So it's like, if you're good and you bring a lot of people, you're almost guaranteed a spot in the top three. But it was, it's like, I know some really good contest winners, some really good comedians that won contests that it's almost like a kiss of death that they haven't done. I don't know. I think this is what the kiss of death is, having a good job. Do you have a good job?
It's okay.
Okay. So a good job would be, like, bad, because then you'd get to a point where you're like, I'll never be able to retire from this in order to take the pay cut to do comedy seriously.
Yeah.
But if you have, like, an okay job and you can figure out how to, like, maintain paying gigs... What with your job? Do you need to take a phone call? We can pause.
No, it's okay.
We're going to wrap up here soon. One last question, and then we'll do our last roundup. What's your short-term goal? Like, what's your two-year plan? What would you like to see? Where would you like to see yourself in the next, at the end of 2 years from today, what would you like to be saying about your comedy career?
I think my two-year goal from today would be, I want three different host sets, working host sets in 2 years, which would be, you know, about 20 to 25 minutes, maybe working on a residency somewhere to get featured. But that's pretty ambitious, I think. But, I mean, if you're not ambitious, then what's the point?
Sure.
So.
Sure. I think having the material to do to be able to be in those positions is more important than actually having the opportunities. Like, a residency to me is a very new concept. There was no residencies when I started, and that was not that long ago.
Yeah.
But the ability to have, like, so I told Haywood Banks one time, I was like, I want a G set and like a PG-13 set, and he's like, make it all G. There's no money in dirt. He's like, because if it's really funny, it'll work in a dirty room. There's nobody that doesn't laugh at funny. Everybody laughs at funny. That's and it true. Doesn't have to be dirty. And I thought, yeah, well, I kind of like telling dirty jokes too. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's one of those things. Like, I still don't think there's a reason not to have two different. But I get that school of thought. I'm just not the type of person that would be like, what I do is the best or whatever. But I think you should definitely develop that stuff. But I think that how many, like, shows have you done in this past year? Like, a number of.
Since January 1st, I've done 70.
Since January 1st of 2016?
Yes. Yeah.
70 shows.
Yeah.
And that's like open mic, bar open show, mics, bar shows, whatever, shoe case, guest set.
Yeah.
Wow. Since January. So I'm trying to think. We're not even 6 months in yet. We're like 5 months in. So you
my
easily,
goal was 100 for the year, and I'm...
Oh, you're going to clock that out.
Yep, 71. I'm at 71. Yeah.
And so you started in what month? Comedy doing, like,
I started June 2nd of last year.
June, so between June and January, how many shows did you do?
That I don't know. I wasn't counting.
Okay.
But definitely maybe 50.
Yeah, it sounds about right for me. I think my first year I did 34 shows, but it was like I started like in March or something like that. But from January to January that next year, I think I did 150 shows or something like that. Close to it. And, I thought, wow, that's great. And I counted and counted and counted until I started doing maybe 2 years, second or third week of my 2 years in, I started realizing, like, I'm not using this information. I'm not gaining any information from all these shows that I've done. And I just stopped. Like, I used to write it in the margins of all my notebooks, like the date. So if that was the way I'd keep that notebook. If I was writing dates in it, I knew I was going to be writing a lot of jokes in that notebook. And I would always say, like, I'd rate myself like a letter grade on how well I thought I did. And I've gone back to it, to some of those early notebooks for historical value. Like, what date did I actually start doing comedy? But that's like once or twice.
Yeah.
And now Facebook does it all for you. Yeah, like, this day in history. I saw my original start date at Wiley's, and I was like,
oh, there you go.
That's crazy.
Yeah, you don't really gain too much from that. Like, I used to go in and grade all my jokes, you know, stars, 4 out of 5.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, what? No, just do it. And if people laugh, then you just keep doing it. Like, yeah, I'm overthinking it in a way.
Yeah, because the key is to, like, get a 3-star joke up to 5 stars. And sort of, like, admitting that it's a 3-star joke at any given point kind of puts a lot of pressure on you, I feel. And undue pressure, not a lot, but undue pressure to get it to a certain place. So at the end of 2 years, like, do you see yourself like doing feature work regularly, or just like just glimpsing, like getting into doing 20, 30 minutes?
Probably just glimpsing at it, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm just
you're a year now in trying now, to get into hosting. So that'd be 3 years. Yeah, yeah, but it all happens pretty fast for those that want it. And I'd say, you're going to learn a lot, especially in Dayton. There's just so many opportunities for a small market, you know, especially for people that stay true and don't piss anybody off. You'll get a lot of opportunities. I'd say I see you within 3 years, definitely doing, having the ability to do the feature spots, whether or not those opportunities come are way out of our grasp.
Right. Well, that's another thing is, like, I think you have to take initiative and create your own opportunities. I wouldn't have had 70 shows this year if I didn't start an open mic.
Sure.
And we started 2 open mics. Now it's only 1, but I wouldn't be this far. Now, has that helped me get better? I'm not sure. But you, in a way, have to create your own opportunities.
I agree. And I think also the exercise of starting an open mic, just going and acquiring the open mic itself, is probably scary for some people.
It was. I don't think I could have done it by myself, but Luke Capasso helped me. He's my business partner.
He's also my my artist.
There you go.
For my latest t-shirt design and other designs of the past and future designs to come. So we'll end the podcast on this. I don't have them with me, but I have your business cards. They're done.
Oh, fantastic.
And so I want to explain the concept to you before I actually give you the reveal.
All right.
So I hired an artist to do a rendering of the picture from you from Myrtle's Punch House.
Okay.
Which is a picture I know you like.
Yes.
And that was a picture we discussed as being like, this is a good look for you.
Yeah.
So I made a couple modifications, but there's an age progression for this sequence of photos.
Okay.
So there's 6 images in all.
All right.
The image itself is just you on stage holding a microphone. It's a little bit more flattering.
Okay.
Than what I would say you're dressed today, but it's your stage outfit or whatever, and it's caricature in nature. And the first image is rough sketch. The lines are still kind of in it. And you can tell it's like a rough draft of what eventually the next version of it is cleaned up. There's no lines in it, but it's straight lines or whatever. And then the third version is the exact same image, but it's completely cleaned up and polished. So this image should last you for at least 3 years.
Okay.
This card, the cards that I got you, it's like 250 or whatever, my gift to you, is just so that you get in the habit of handing them out and giving them to people that matter. It's got the most basic amount of information on it. There's very little design quality. It just has the image on the front and back and your information. And then there's no phone number because there's a big blank spot in there because you should write your phone number on it for anybody who needs it.
Okay.
You shouldn't be just giving out your phone number.
Right, yeah.
And as a comedian. In general, as anybody. But if you really need somebody, you write that. That's a nice touch, is what we say in the business. So this card has the rough draft image on it. I will send you the copy of the string of images that have the more polished ones. But when you look at this one, you'll be like, oh, that's great, because it's a great-looking character. But when you see the final draft, it's really nice.
Okay.
It's really nice. And that's something that, like, I want you to be able to design your own card over time. Not necessarily based around what this card is, but just based around the idea of you're going to be better next year.
Okay.
And the year after that, you're going to be even more polished. So have it be like when you need new cards, you might order the next batch with this same image or a version of this image or whatever before you decide, like, now that I'm actually getting regular MC work and some feature spots or whatever, I'm going to upgrade my card, make a new design, add some new information, because you do book shows and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I didn't put that information on there, but you might want a separate card just for that. That card probably wouldn't have your image on it. But anyway, I'm very happy to have been able to, it was a fun project for me because I've never done anything like that before. I don't want you to think that I'm some like great business card designer or anything like that. I was kind of just putting it off this whole time because I wanted to get this artwork done, which took a little bit longer than I would have anticipated, but I never push an artist, and I didn't want to use Luke because I didn't want, he knows you too well.
Yeah.
So I used somebody that kind of knew you, but not that well. So let's get out of here and we'll go take a look at these cards.
All right.
Thanks,
cool.
Joe.
Thanks.